This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Throughout his life and after his death, readers have found political meanings in the children's books of Dr. Seuss. The Lorax told us to speak for the trees, and he became a symbol for environmentalists, and any budget-cutting politician is liable to be labeled a Grinch. Sometimes Theodore Geisel himself protested the ways that people used his words, but there was a political viewpoint behind his work, and some scholars argue there's a lot of literary value, too. The 100th anniversary of the doctor's birth is coming next month, and in this hour we'll ask what Dr. Seuss was trying to tell us. We also want to know what you learned from Dr. Seuss. Tell us a story about when you read Dr. Seuss, either as a child or with your children. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, and the address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Philip Nell, who is author of a book about Dr. Seuss, an analysis of his work called Dr. Seuss, American Icon. Mr. Nell, welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the book as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Seuss was born in 1904, if we do the math, of course. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. He was born in 1904 in Springfield, but go on.
Springfield, Massachusetts. How did his childhood affect the work that he did later on?
Well, that's a good question. He, as a child, I mean, one of the things that he claims influenced his work was listening to his mother recite the names of pies. The pies she was making as something that influenced his sense of rhyme. Certainly some of the books he read as a child, I think, influenced him when he grew up. He read the work of Peter Newell and Hilaire Belloc, who did Cautionary Tales for Children, which have, I think, to modern readers, sort of an Edward Gorey-like feel to them. They're dark and funny and in rhyme. I think something else would be his many visits to the zoo, although later in life he would say that his father was superintendent of zoos, and as a child he went to the zoo because his father was superintendent of zoos. His father didn't actually become in charge of the zoos until later, but he did visit the zoos as a child, and there are all those fantastic creatures in his books, which one must connect with a delight in seeing animals. So that's something else, I guess, that would connect it back to his childhood.
We can imagine
lots of
that
things,
he went
really.
We can imagine that he went to zoos because he loved them, I suppose.
Because he loved them, he liked to draw too. He liked to draw from a very young age. He always claimed that he couldn't draw. You know, he always said, I try to draw a kangaroo and it comes out looking like a Grinch. Was one of the things that he would say. But of course he could draw, and certainly that enjoyment in drawing started as a young child. Perhaps in spite of some of the instruction that he received, he often told a story of being in an art class, I believe it was in high school, and turning his paper upside down. And he said, what he was doing was, although he didn't know it at the time, was checking the composition, and that if something looks wrong when it's upside down, then it's also wrong when it's right side up.
Oh, yeah.
But his teacher saw him doing that and said, Theodore, real artists don't turn their papers upside down. And so Seuss liked to say that he walked out of that art class and never took another one again.
Now, he grew up to become an advertising man, Dr. Seuss did, the man who later became known as Dr. Seuss, and you report in your book that he also became a political cartoonist for a time.
He did. Yes, he did. He first got his name with the Quick Henry, the Flit advertising campaign for Flit bug spray, which became a national catchphrase. People of a certain generation will know that catchphrase. He was known for that well before he became known for his children's books. And in fact, in the very first political cartoon he published, he's identified as Dr. Seuss, famous advertising man known for Quick Henry the Flit. But yes, he did. He did over 400 political cartoons between April of 1941 and January of 1943 in the liberal New York newspaper PM. And they were anti-fascist cartoons. They were anti-racist cartoons, and they were arguing that America should get involved.
This was a time when America was considering getting involved in World War II, right?
And many people did not want to get involved, and he was very worried that isolationism at home left the country vulnerable, and he wanted to give his fellow citizens a wake-up call and say that, you know, we need to get involved in this war, we need to get ready for it, we can't stick our heads in the sand and hope it will go away. One of his favorite motifs in those cartoons is an ostrich. He would draw the isolationists, the America First organizations, as ostriches sticking their heads in the sand.
We're talking to Philip,
Charles Lindbergh.
We're talking to Philip Nell, who is the author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon, about the politics and literary meaning in the works of Dr. Seuss. And we want to know what you have learned over the years from Dr. Seuss or that your children have. All you have to do is call us at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. We're going to go to the phones in a moment. But just before we do, Philip Nell, can you just describe how the politics you just described with Dr. Seuss doing editorial cartoons and so forth informed the man's later work as a children's book author?
Oh, absolutely. In the message books that he wrote after the Second World War, you can really see his political commitment coming through. And I think that's because writing the political cartoons really galvanized his sense of wanting to write books that changed people's minds. He said that he wrote The Sneetches because of his opposition to anti-Semitism.
This is the book where the star-bellied Sneetches are trying to lord it over those who don't have stars,
right,
upon thars.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And at the end of the book, we learn that no kind of Sneetch is the best on the beaches. And that's clearly a book that works as a message against racial discrimination, as well as, of course, against discrimination against Jewish people. And that clearly, I think, comes out of his war work. He also wrote Yertle the Turtle as a parable about the rise of Hitler. That may be the most popular anti-fascist book ever written. And that, for those who may not remember it, Yertle the Turtle literally builds his throne, builds his empire on the backs of other turtles who all suffer under his rule, and that's a common theme in the cartoons that he draws for PM during the war, that Hitler is starving his people to build his empire. There's one great cartoon where there's a German father talking to his child, and they're both obviously very hungry, and the cupboard is bare, and the German father says to the child, you know, food? We Germans don't eat food. We eat countries, he says. And that's Seuss's his satirical comment on what Hitler's doing to his people.
And then there's the Butter Battle Book. We could go on for a while.
The Butter Battle Book. Well, the Butter Battle Book was inspired by his opposition to Ronald Reagan's escalation of the nuclear arms race, which he thought was crazy. And so that's what he set out to prove. And the connection between that and the war work is mainly his decision to express his political beliefs in his children's books and to use his position as a popular children's book author to try to put progressive social messages out there. There's nothing in the wartime cartoons about an arms race, of course, because there wasn't one at the time. But that's what inspired it, his opposition to Reagan's escalation of the arms race.
Philip Nell, stay with us if you would while we go to Jen in Durham, North Carolina. Jen, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. I love the show.
Thanks. What did you learn from Dr. Seuss?
Well, I have to start by saying I'm now currently a first grade teacher here in Durham, but I grew up with Dr. Seuss. My grandmother was a third grade teacher, and so she read Dr. Seuss to me a lot as a child, and I continue to share Dr. Seuss with just about everybody I run into, but especially with my students in the first grade. And what Dr. Seuss kind of taught me, aside from all the wonderful political and cultural views, was just how much fun words and playing with words and sounds can be, and how exciting changing a couple of letters might make a new sentence or a new word that would just capture the right sound or idea. And I always thought Dr. Seuss was fantastic for that.
Thanks, Jen. Philip Nell, is Dr. Seuss subversive in any way in the way that he uses the language?
Oh, absolutely. I think Jen's really hit on something there. I mean, he is famous for making up words, and he has changed the language itself with some of the words that he's made up. For example, the word nerd first occurs in Dr. Seuss's If I Ran the Zoo. Very few poets or writers have changed the language itself.
Did they use? Did he use nerd the same way that we use nerd today as kind of a...
That's a good question. That's the first recorded instance of the use of the word nerd, and it does describe a character who arguably looks like a nerd. So, possibly. It's the earliest recorded instance of it. Grinch might be a better example, although there are earlier recorded uses of that word. They're fairly obscure, but I think one's from the 17th century and one's from the 18th century. He's the one who gave Grinch the meaning that it now has. So that might be a better example of a word that he has made part of the language. And, you know, Lewis Carroll changed the language with some of the words he created. Edward Lear did. So he, in that sense, is really one of the great nonsense poets. And the subversive part of that is it encourages people to be creative. You know, it encourages people not to accept the rules. Why should language work this way? Why don't we change it? Why don't we make up our own words? It's no coincidence that one of his books is called Oh, the Thinks You Can Think. He wanted people to think. He wanted people to be creative. One of his books, On Beyond Zebra, he actually makes up letters. He makes up letters for all the words that are beyond zebra, but you can't spell them because you don't know the letters that come beyond zebra.
If only
zebra.
You knew.
If only you knew, exactly. And so he makes up all these letters for these fantastic creatures that we could see and we could spell if we were willing to go beyond zebra. So I think that's the subversive part.
We're getting a lot of phone calls here. As you can imagine, lots of people have stories to share about Dr. Seuss. You can join the conversation by calling 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. And let's go to Nancy in Memphis, Tennessee, who called that number and has been holding patiently. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, good afternoon. I can't wait to read the book. But when I was a senior in high school in AP English, I wrote my thesis on Theodore Gazelle's use of John Locke's educational philosophy in his Dr. Seuss works.
John Locke's educational philosophy?
Because John Locke's educational philosophy, if I remember correctly, this was 15 years ago, is that education should be fun. And, I mean, very different than his political philosophy in many ways. But that he believed that education should engage children to make them want to learn. And if you look at the impact that Dr. Seuss has had on society, on American society, it does do that. I mean, children enjoy reading the books. They're easy for them to learn. They are accessible to children with speech impediments as well as other learning disabilities. It really engages a young mind and makes them exactly like the earlier caller and your guest today. It makes them be creative. Lets them be creative. It goes with the imagination that children naturally have.
Philip Nell, is there something to that connection between Dr. Seuss and John Locke?
Well, Seuss certainly believed that education should be fun. That's why he wrote The Cat in the Hat. In the 50s, people were worried, why can't Johnny read? And Dr. Seuss's answer to that question was that the Dick and Jane primers were really boring. So, in response, he wrote The Cat in the Hat and Green Eggs and Ham and One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, and The Cat in the Hat Comes Back and Hop on Pop. And the point of writing these books was to make reading fun, was to make children want to read. And that's what these books are. They're really fun to read. That's very much Seuss's educational philosophy. He believed that reading should be fun and that education should be fun. And if it's not, you're going to lose kids. He used to say of the way that he wrote that he would say that adults will put up with a lot, but kids won't. You know, he'd say, you can't fool a kid. If your story isn't sound, it doesn't go along properly, the kid will just close the book.
Nancy, in just 2 or 3 seconds, do you have a favorite Dr. Seuss book?
You know, I can't remember, but in 2 or 3 seconds, I think it's a shame the marketing that's been going on with Dr. Seuss's works at this point, because he was actually, and I could be wrong and your guest can correct me, but if I remember from 15 years ago doing my research, he was very opposed to the commercialization in that manner.
Oh, let's talk. We're going to talk more about that after the break. But that's okay. But thanks very much for your call, Nancy. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the topic.
And we are going to bring up that subject and others after the break. We're talking about Dr. Seuss, who is celebrating, or will be celebrating, his 100th birthday next month. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington. We are talking about the master of sneeches, the Lord of the Lorax, the creator of The Cat in the Hat, Dr. Seuss, our subject this hour, and Philip Nell is our guest, and you are invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. We're getting lots of emails. Here's a couple of them. We get a note here saying that from Brad Leifring saying, Dr. Seuss's writing should be read to small children with the following warning. Napping fathers all over have been rudely awakened by a massive weight landing on them, giggling, hop, hop, hop on pop. The only proper painful response is stop, stop, do not hop on pop. I've had three separate incidents with three different perpetrators, although all of us have survived, reports Brad from Prairie Village, Kansas. You do get a sense there, Philip, of the way that Dr. Seuss can influence the kids.
Yeah. Yeah, he got very tired of being served green eggs and ham, too, whenever he went to make an appearance, also inspired by his books.
Oh, gosh. Well, getting on to a slightly more serious subject here, Nancy, before the break, was complaining about what she thought was the commercialization of Dr. Seuss. We also have an email from Mary O'Brien at the University of Minnesota Foundation, or rather just in Minnesota, we'll say. She says that I do not like the marketing in ways such as the movie that came out, the Cat in the Hat movie recently. It was potty humor, and that's not what Dr. Seuss was about. I also don't like cartoons that are turned into movies with human actors, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You write a chapter of your book about what you call the Disneyfication of Dr. Seuss, the way that he became a big industry. Is that what Dr. Seuss wanted?
That's an excellent question. I think the short answer to that question is this. The difference between the Seuss products that were produced when he was alive and the Seuss products that have been made since he died is the following. During his life, you never saw his characters promoting other products. They weren't selling hamburgers or credit cards or cleaning products or cereal or cookies. I think that's the big difference between what happened during his life and after his death. There's a longer answer to this question, and I don't know how much of an answer you want, but I'll keep going and you can interrupt at any time.
Well, just tell me, is there a principle that he followed? Because I know there were endorsements that he approved during his life. What did he support? What did he resist?
Well, he was not for consumption for its own sake. He did allow some of his characters to be made into products. I mean, there was a Cat in the Hat alarm clock, there was a Sears bedroom set, there was a CNC story maker. There were products made by Seuss, but you didn't see his characters selling other people's products, at least not that I know of. They were selling products based on themselves. So would he have opposed this is the question that everybody wants to know. Well, I talked with the people at Dr. Seuss Enterprises, and Dr. Seuss Enterprises is the entity that oversees the production of all Seuss products, from the books to the movies to the merchandise, everything. And on the executive board of that are three people, one of whom is Audrey Geisel, who is his widow, another of whom is Herb Chayette, and he's the person with whom I spoke the most. He was Seuss's agent. And the other one is Carl Zabel, who was also involved in business with Seuss. So they make the decisions. And what they will tell you is this. First, they will tell you that when Seuss died, he was working on a screenplay for Oh, the Places You'll Go. And he had signed the rights to the same kinds of merchandising and marketing agreements that were then done for the Grinch movie and for the Cat in the Hat movie. So that's what they will cite as a reason for why some of these things are being done.
Well, let's listen to a production that Dr. Seuss approved of and I believe participated in during his life. In 1966, the holiday TV classic How the Grinch Stole Christmas was born, and I want to play a little clip of that. This is Boris Karloff, the voice of the Grinch.
They'll do something I hate most of all. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, will stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'll stand hand in hand, and those Whos start singing.
Doris, Doris, don't you just want to sing along, Phil?
I always think of the wonderful lyrics to the Grinch song, which, you know, he wrote, where he says he calls him a wonderful set of descriptions, you know, that you're a three-decker sauerkraut and toadstool sandwich with arsenic sauce. I love the language he uses, and that comes across there.
The three words that describe you are as follows, and I
right,
quote.
Right, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk.
All right.
Those are great. Yeah.
Now, on the other side of the coin here, at least more recently, The Cat in the Hat was made into a movie in 2003, and we want to play a bit of a scene here from, in which we'll hear the family goldfish, voiced by Sean Hayes, scolding the children for letting the cat in the hat, a.k.a. Mike Myers, into the house.
Stop this right now!
Uh-huh. Who said that?
Me! Remember the fish? Came home in a baggie, loved me for 2 weeks, and then nothing!
The fish is talking.
Well, sure, he can talk, but is he saying anything?
No, not really. No.
Hey, Socks! Can it! This cat should not be here. He should not be about. He should not be here when your mother is out.
Come on, kids. You're gonna listen to him? He drinks where he pees.
Can I just ask what Theodore Geisel thought about obscenity, potty humor, whatever you want to call it?
Well, it didn't make its way into his books. He did have an adolescent sense of humor, but it did not necessarily come into his books. One of the things that he liked to do to keep his editors on their toes was to slip in manuscript pages that were deliberately offensive to see if they were paying attention.
Oh, yeah?
So for example, in Dr. Seuss's ABC, the page for X, the original one, which was there to keep his editors on his toes and which is not in the book, Dr. Seuss's ABC, but the original one for the letter X has a picture of a large-breasted woman, and it says, Big X, little X, XXX. Someday, kiddies, you will learn about sex. His editors caught that, of course. No, he didn't, in the books, didn't have potty humor, although he did have an adult sense of humor, which appears in other places.
Well, he certainly had an adult sense of politics, and we got an email here from Val Blaha. And Val writes, I remember watching the cartoon movie of The Lorax as a child in elementary school and being extremely moved by the story and the music as an adult reader of The Lorax. I'm going to say that again, an adult reader of The Lorax. I'm very impressed at how the story portrays a picture of corporate greed and short-sightedness about environmental repercussions of this greed. It seems just as valid a cautionary tale as when he wrote it. Somebody very affected by The Lorax there. I have to say, I vividly remember watching The Lorax, too.
Yeah, no, The Lorax has inspired many people. When the book was published, he received an award from the Keep America Beautiful Foundation, who predicted that the book would inspire many people, and it really has. It really has done. Many environmentalists, and of course, it's also inspired many opposition as well. The Lorax is remarkable because he's a fictional character with real enemies. He has been opposed by people in some logging communities who have lobbied to get him off of school reading lists and out of school libraries, earning the Lorax a place on the American Library Association's banned book list. There's even an anti-Lorax book called Truax, which is put out by a hardwood flooring manufacturers association, which has a kindly white logger who plays the role of Truax, who is a very responsible logger, and then Gardbark, who is this very angry, brown-skinned environmentalist.
Because they thought
the villain of the book.
Because the loggers thought that this book insulted them, made them look bad.
Yes, yes, they thought that it was anti-logging. Seuss's response to that was that it's not anti-logging, it's anti-greed. It's about going easy on what we've got. He said, you know, look, I write books that are printed on paper. I write at a desk made out of wood. I'm not anti-logging, but I am anti-greed, and the book is anti-greed. They cut down the truffula trees, but they also pollute the waters, pollute the air. You know, it's a book about conserving the environment and taking care of the environment.
We're talking to Philip Nell, the author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon, and let's find out how Dr. Seuss affected Peggy, who called us from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. I'm furiously trying to write notes here so I can be...
Oh, that's okay. Speak extemporaneously. It's live radio. Fire away.
Yeah, I'm doing it, so...
You're a pro. I'm an early childhood educator, and that's beside the point, except that I were greed Seuss all the time. But when I was a child, I remember Horton Hears a Who... Mm-hmm. As a book that actually absolutely changed my life. I still think of it as Horton is my philosopher. Horton helped me to understand for the very first time the concept of, what we learned in church. A great big being helping a teeny-weeny being, you know, the sparrows.
Horton is the elephant who saves a little tiny microscopic community of ooze.
Yes, Horton listens.
Right.
Horton listens. And
he
Horton
does.
Heard this little teeny-weeny who, and everybody else was going to bomb Whoville, or whatever they were going to do to Whoville. But Horton goes on a mission to save this who, and he goes into a great big field of kind of dandelion-like puffs.
Right.
Looking
right.
at the teeny-weeny who.
Mm-hmm.
And he finds the who and saves the who world.
Okay.
But I have to say that at the time I was reading it, it helped me to understand how, it helped me to understand the ecology.
The way that you have to look after everything around you.
The way that we as people, who are the Hortons of the globe, need to look out for the who's, who are the teeny-weeny little beings who we step on every day without thinking about.
Well, Peggy, thanks very much for your call from Madison, Wisconsin. I really appreciate it.
And can I tell you that Cat in the Hat has always made me very nervous.
Well, don't worry about it. It happens to a lot of us. Thanks for your call, Peggy. Appreciate it.
I think he'd make me nervous, too, if he came to my house. Seuss himself said that, he was asked, if he were invited to dinner with his characters, who would he like to have dinner with? And he said, if I was invited to dinner with my characters, I wouldn't show up. So I think you're not the only person who the Cat in the Hat makes nervous.
Philip, now the theme of Horton Hears a Who in the end is a person's a person no matter how small. Can you tell
Don't
me?
Don't give up.
Can you
believe in you all. Sorry, you
got
me.
It's quite
going.
All right. It's quite all right. Can you tell me the way that that phrase has been used politically over the years?
Well, yes. Anti-choice groups, let's say groups opposed to...
Anti-abortion groups.
Yeah. They have tried to use that slogan to say that Seuss was also opposed to abortion, and he wasn't, and in fact sued one such group for using it on their stationery. But I've still seen it used in the literature and in the pamphlets that anti-abortion groups put out. That's not what he was going after there. I think if you want to read it politically, there are a lot of ways to read it, but that isn't the way to do it. It is, I think, a plea for the rights of everyone. You know, smallness in the book is about power, and it's about lack of power, and it's about, even the small, even the powerless have rights. So you can see it as a book about the rights of minorities, about the rights of children. I mean, I think one thing that's really appealing about that from a child's point of view is a person's a person, no matter how small. How many children have felt put upon, have felt, oppressed by the big people in their lives making all the decisions. And one of the things that I love about Horton Hears a Who, and in fact many of the political books, is that it's the smallest who of all who saves the day. The who's have to make themselves heard. Everyone has to speak up, even the smallest. It's little Jojo, the smallest who of all, who shouts the yop, that puts it over the top, gets the who's heard, and in so doing, everyone is going to protect them. So.
Well, Philip, now let's take a very brief pause so that we can listen for any who's who may be sounding out there.
That's a good idea.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I think I heard one.
You did?
I don't know. But anyway, 800-989-TALK is the number you can call. That's 800-989-8255 if you want to join our discussion. And Tom called that number from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Tom. Tom, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You were listening for some who's yourself, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I am thrilled with your topic today. And there's so many things I could say about Dr. Seuss, but I'll be concise.
Yeah, if you could pick one, that'd be great, because there's a lot of people calling.
People are only familiar with him through his children's books. They're missing a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And there's been some talk about whether the Cat in the Hat movie was really in keeping with what he would have wanted. I think that long after everybody has forgotten the Cat in the Hat movie, there will still be, now and then, you'll come across someone who will have seen The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, which is a movie that came out in the 50s. Somehow, miraculously, with set design, he managed to make a movie with live actors have the same kind of look and feel as his children's books. The gist of this story was that there was an evil piano teacher who would had an
affair
to kidnap a bunch of his students and somehow thereby gain power. But Seuss actually made some other films in the World War II era, kind of documentary propaganda films, and I was wondering if your guest had anything to say about those. You know, again, he was just a marvelously accomplished man in many areas, not just children's books.
Philip Nell, tell me if any of the other films are still available and if they're worth watching, and thanks for the call, Tom.
Well, I don't know if they're still available. They are interesting to watch. He, during the Second World War, was in a propaganda division for the United States under none other than Frank Capra, the famous director of It's a Wonderful Life and many other films. And he did do some documentary films, Your Job in Germany, Your Job in Japan. Your Job in Germany, I believe, was later released as Hitler Lives and won an Academy Award under that title. I think the interesting thing about those films, well, there are a lot of interesting things about them. I guess the one about Japan strikes me as interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, that particular film was considered too sympathetic towards the Japanese and was prevented from being shown, if I remember correctly, which is very interesting in light of the World War II cartoons, some of which, although they are definitely against racism against African-Americans or against Jewish people, they definitely present the Japanese in a very... Well, a way we'd find very offensive today.
Seuss's cartoons were not kind to the internees, the Japanese Americans.
No, they weren't. No, they weren't. They were, I mean, there's one in particular which really seems to justify the internment of Japanese Americans. It shows them all lined up along the West Coast, sort of waiting for orders from home. And there's a little booth where there's one Japanese American passing out boxes of TNT to on the honorable fifth column, as it's called. And fifth column would be those members of an enemy who are within your own country. So the film certainly shows, I think, Seuss's position shifting.
Okay, well, Philip Nell, thanks very much. We're going to actually continue another 20 minutes here on this topic since we have so many calls on it. 800-989-TALK, the number to call to join our discussion. That's 800-989-8255. And we've got more right after this break. So don't take a snooze. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking to the author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon. That's Philip Nell. And we're asking what you have learned from Dr. Seuss, a children's author who was surprisingly political when you think about it. If you want to join the discussion, you can call 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And we'd like to learn one little bit of trivia before we continue here, Philip Nell. Terry Moore sends us an email and says that Terry's favorite Dr. Seuss story is To Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. And here's the question. Terry notes that there is a Mulberry Street in New York City, a very famous street. Is that the same Mulberry Street that's described in the Dr. Seuss book?
No, it's probably the Mulberry Street, in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is where he grew up. And if I'm not mistaken, the Mulberry Street in Springfield, Massachusetts, actually does run into Bliss, as it does in the book.
And I should mention, since you're mentioning Springfield, Massachusetts, I see in your book a photograph of an industrial plant in Springfield, Massachusetts, and then you go from that to a picture of from the Lorax, the drawing of the factory in the Lorax that's being used to destroy all the trees. Something of a resemblance, a similarity there.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, to go back to your opening question, he recycled the images of his childhood, and they show up in his books in many ways. And in fact, if people have an interest in pursuing that further, Charles Cohen has a new book out called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But The Seuss. And he explores some of that in his book. But yeah, definitely. There's definitely a connection there.
Well, let's see how Dr. Seuss affected the landscape of the childhoods of some of our listeners, starting with Bobby in Kensington, California. Hi, Bobby.
Hi.
So you're a Dr. Seuss reader, I guess?
Well, a little bit now since I have two young girls, but I just wanted to relay a memory that I had when I was a child. Every Christmas, our father used to dress my sister and I up in a little tent that had three holes in it, and one hole was for his head, and we sat on either side of him, and then we put on funny Who hats. And we recited The Grinch Who Stole Christmas for all of our other relatives, and it became a Christmas tradition. And since then, of course, I've thought of him as a very fun-loving author, and am anxious to have my children, who are a little too young to appreciate all of it, get into it. And then I just also wanted to say that another previous caller mentioned the 10,000 Fingers of Dr. Terwilliger, and I must say I rented that recently a couple of years ago, and I was pretty scandalized by the content of that.
Is that Cindy Lou Who in the background there?
Yeah, it is Cindy Lou, the future Cindy Lou. But the 10,000 Fingers of Dr. Terwilliger struck me as almost, maybe I'm prude, but almost homoerotic, and I wondered what your guest had to say about that.
Philip Nell, what do you think? And Bobby, thanks for the call. I'll let you sit there with what's your kid's name, by the way?
Mallory.
I'll let you sit there with Mallory. Thanks very much for
Thank
the call.
You.
Bye. Philip, what do you think?
Well, for the record, Seuss didn't like the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T and disowned it after it came out. He was disappointed by the way that it came out. As to whether or not it's homoerotic, I personally didn't see that, although perhaps an argument could be made in that direction. I am an English professor, after all, so I suppose it's possible to interpret it anyway. But, I mean, I would see it, I guess, some of the strange subtext of that film that I see is this kind of nightmares of persecution that the little boy who's forced to play piano has to undergo, and kind of a Cold War politics seeping in there. At the end of it, I mean, not only is the little boy sort of persecuted by these enemies, seen and unseen, but at the end of it, it culminates in this great big atomic explosion. So those are the political undercurrents that come to my mind. I don't know about the other ones. They may well be there, but I haven't thought about them.
Let's look at another possible undercurrent of Dr. Seuss's books, spotted by William in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Oh, thank you. I had a question, actually. It seems that some of Dr. Seuss's themes seem to be co-opted by a certain segment of the counterculture and seem to have a lot of drug references. And I was curious if Dr. Seuss ever stated an opinion on that, and if so, what it was.
Can you describe, off the top of your head, any of the drug references you're thinking of?
Well, the new movie that came out actually seemed to play on some of them, in The Cat in the Hat. And I know in The Places You'll Go, I've seen like postcards and things that seem to have like Dr. Timothy Leary, his face on them with the colorful background, and the same subtext, "Oh, the places you'll go." Just to name a couple.
Thanks for the call, William. Philip Nell, anything there?
Well, I don't think Seuss would have approved of those, and in fact, those bootleg Seuss materials are some of the reasons that Dr. Seuss Enterprises will cite as reasons for making these movies, because in so doing, they protect their property via trademark law. As to any connections between Seuss and interesting substances, there aren't really very many. I mean, you know, he drank socially, but you know, he wasn't a heavy drinker. I guess the best story to tell in that regard would be how he came to use the name Seuss, and that is, during his senior year at Dartmouth College, he was the editor of the humor magazine, Jack-O-Lantern, and this was during Prohibition, and he and some friends were caught drinking gin in his room, and as punishment, the dean stripped him of his editorship and prevented him from contributing to the magazine anymore. He used to contribute cartoons to it. So that didn't stop him. He kept contributing but began to use other names like El Pastor, for example, D.G. Rossetti, Class of 25. and T-Seuss and Seuss. And that's the first time that he uses Seuss as his pseudonym. So that's the big connection, I guess, you could draw between controlled substances, if you will, and Dr. Seuss. But I don't think he would like these spin-off products, which he did not license.
Somewhat cat-in-the-hat-like behavior there, I guess.
Oh, yes. No, he was a big fan of practical jokes. There's one story of he and a friend buying a bench that was exactly like the benches in Central Park, and then going and sitting on it with a friend until a policeman walked by, and then he and the friend pick up the bench and start walking away with it. The policeman stops them for stealing a bench, and they produce a receipt. he was a fan of practical jokes, and he definitely had a subversive sense of humor.
Well, let's get another question for Philip Nell, author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon, and we will go to Mark in Jacksonville, California. Thanks for holding, Mark, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
No, this is Jacksonville, Florida, too.
What's that?
No, this is Jacksonville, Florida, too.
Okay.
This is a great conversation. I was just marveling at how imprinted some of these stories are. I mean, you were talking about Horton Hears a Who, and I could immediately, one of my funniest part of the funniest part of the books is where that character yells "Yop," and I could just see that in my mind's eye from the book. But my favorite book of his is, and you haven't mentioned it yet, I must have learned to read on this. I can still see my mom reading it to me every night when I was 3 or 4. Was The Big Book of Sleep?
Dr. Seuss's sleep book.
Yes, it was excellent.
Yes.
I mean, it was one of his bigger books, and I mean, it's
yes,
really
it was.
Large format even for a kid. But I still have that same copy I used as a kid.
Did you ever make it to the end, or did you always fall asleep?
I could probably recite it by rote. I mean, I must have been read from it 100 times. But no, it's an excellent book. But my question was this, and I guess I should probably know this, but was Theodore Geisel a father? And if so, what kind of father was he?
His first wife, Helen, could not have children, so he never had children of his own. His standard response to interviewers' questions was, "You make 'em, I'll amuse 'em." So he never had children of his own. His second wife, Audrey, did have children from a previous marriage who became his stepdaughters, but him as a father, there's not really much that one can say since he didn't really... he didn't have children of his own, and his stepdaughters, I think, were already in their teens when they became his stepdaughters, if I'm not mistaken. So I know that Lark Grey Diamond Cates, who is one of the stepdaughters, credits him with inspiring her to become an artist. She is the person who designed the sculptures at the Dr. Seuss National Memorial Park in Springfield. So perhaps there's something to go on there. He also had a close relationship with his nephew Ted Owens, who I think became, in some senses, a kind of surrogate son for him. And I know that they would spend hours together in his studio. So, I think he got along well with children. In fact, I think he liked talking to children better than to adults in many respects. In fact, one reason that he credited for the success of his books is he said, quote, "I don't write for children, I write for people." And I think it's treating children as people is what makes him successful as a writer, and I think in his relations with children as well.
Great.
Okay.
Right. Thank you,
Mark. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. And let's go now to Dana in Boulder, Colorado. Dana, thanks for holding, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a mother of a one-year-old and so anxious to start the Dr. Seuss books. I'm wondering what are the most accessible ones for little kids who are maybe more into the pictures than... and interested in the rhymes and that kind of thing.
Well, I would definitely have to go with some of the beginner books there. Green Eggs and Ham, which uses 50 different words. That's one of the simplest. Hop on Pop also has very few words in it. Those would be, maybe One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish.
Yeah.
Those would strike me as the simplest ones, the ones with very few words, largely driven by those words in the pictures.
And let me just mention very briefly for our stations that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call, Dana. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
And now, Philip, now let's go to David in Ithaca, New York, who's been holding patiently for more than half an hour. And thanks very much for waiting so long, David. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, hi. And don't feel bad. I've been eating, in between. so that's fine.
Okay, that's good.
Well, that's good.
Anyway, can I ask a quick question before I tell my story?
Go ahead.
Sure.
I was wondering if there was ever any meeting between Dr. Seuss and Roald Dahl, who's another one of my favorite authors, very different approach to issues about kids.
That's a really good question. I don't know. If anybody would know, it would be Judith and Neil Morgan, who have written an excellent biography called Dr. Seuss and Mr. Geisel. And I would highly recommend that to anybody who's interested in learning more about Seuss. I don't remember if they ever met. If they did, it would have been briefly. I don't recall it from the biography. That doesn't mean that it isn't in there.
Sure. I wondered if they, you know, how they felt about each other's work. I mean, I think.
Yeah. I mean, they both.
Kind of take on, you know, empowering kids.
Well, I guess so. I mean, you know, one thing that you sense in Dahl and in Seuss is an alignment with the point of view of the children and not with that of the adults. I mean,
right.
Dahl has monstrous adults, and Seuss often doesn't include human adults in his books. I mean, think of The Cat in the Hat. You see the mother's leg. You don't see the mother.
Just part of the leg, yeah.
Yeah, just part of the leg, even. So, I mean, I think in that respect, there's a kind of a faith in the wisdom of children against the corrupt world of adulthood that they would share.
David, we've just got a minute left, but you mentioned a story.
Yes, well, I'll keep it brief. Well, as you, I'm sure you've been to high school graduations or college graduations, and there's always the speech that's supposed to inspire the graduates. And I worked at a school here in Ithaca called the Alternative Community School, and the principal, who is known to be a prolific speaker, in fact, he would start his talks by saying, unaccustomed as I am to public speaking. Anyway, one graduation for the high schoolers, instead of giving a talk, he took the book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, had the pictures put on slides, they were projected during the ceremony, and he just read them, read the book.
Wow.
That was
That's
the talk.
Great.
What was the response?
I think it was very good. I know I liked it.
Maybe people learned something from it. Who knows?
Yeah, I think so.
What were you going to say,
I was going to say it's become a popular graduation gift, and I thought since we're probably running out of time here, you might like to hear Seuss's very brief graduation speech that he gave on a few occasions.
Yeah, we've just
or
got
not.
A minute.
I don't know, depending on your time.
If you can do it in 30 seconds, go for it.
All right. It goes like this. My uncle ordered popovers from the restaurant's bill of fare, and when they were served, he regarded them with a penetrating stare. Then he spoke great words of wisdom as he sat there on that chair. To eat these things, said my uncle, you must exercise great care. You may swallow down what's solid, but you must spit out the air. And as you partake of the world's bill of fare, that's darned good advice to follow. Do a lot of spitting out the hot air, and be careful what you swallow.
The words of Dr. Seuss is read by Philip Nell, the author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon. Philip Nell, thanks very much for joining us this hour. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm going to read one last email here from Gary Steinbach in California. He says, when my sister and I were small, on summer evenings after dinner in South Pasadena, Mom would sit on the front porch and read Dr. Seuss books to us. Eventually, the front lawn would be filled with neighborhood kids who had quietly crept within earshot. The readings became somewhat of an institution. And we'll end on those words. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Stevenson.